Okay, chapter 20 of Luke, and we open in prayer. Father, thank you that we can look into your word. We ask you to be with us tonight and guide us in all that we say and guide our hearts so that we can receive the words that you speak to us. We ask that you would teach us and give us the things that we need now to live lives pleasing to thee and that we might grow in the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. Chapter 20, I'll start reading. And it came to pass that one of those days, as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes came upon him with the elders and spake unto him, saying, Tell us, by what authority doest thou these things, and who is he that gave thee this authority? And he answered and said unto them, I will also ask you one thing, and answer me. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or of men? And they reasoned with themselves, saying, If we shall say from heaven, he will say, Why then believed ye him not? But and if we say of men, all the people will stone us, for they be persuaded that John was a prophet. And they answered that they could not tell whence it was. And Jesus said unto them, Neither tell I you by what authority I do these things. I'm going to stop there for a minute, John. The scribes, Pharisees, it says the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders come, and they ask him what by what authority he's saying these things and doing the miracles that he's doing, and Jesus doesn't give them an answer. Why do you think he didn't answer them?
That's always been one of the questions I've had about the, well, two of them. That's one of them, that why didn't he just answer their question, simply? And why didn't they just answer his? Even though I know that there was a dilemma, you would have thought, well, so that we can get the answer from him, let's just say from heaven and receive the criticism, but then we'll be able to get the answer from him. You see what I'm saying? So neither one of them.
I don't know if that would have worked. Because that what's their object for maybe we have to ask this question first. What's their objective? Do you think their objective was in asking him? What were they trying to cause to happen? Or what were they trying to demonstrate to the people?
That, well, I mean, well, obviously they were questioning his authority.
They didn't. I think it's they were tr what they were hoping to achieve in this questioning was to demonstrate to the people that he had no authority, that he was without authority,
Right.
because that's what they believed. The bad thing about trying to respond to that kind of a question is any response you give is worthless. In fact, Jesus is in John, you see where Jesus says, If I testify of myself, my testimony is not true. And the law
Man.
requires that you have two witnesses. There
Right.
has to
And
be
I think
another witness.
there are things in the Proverbs that say that too, that don't by trying to defend something, you've almost lost the argument.
And so, but they couldn't have just started out saying, Jesus, well, yeah, of course it was of heaven, because then, well, then where do you go from there? Then there's no criticism at all. In the eyes of the people, they're going to say, yeah, that's what we're saying. This must be the Messiah. But they don't want to say that, and they don't want to say the alternative because they're playing politics. I don't think that was that Jesus doesn't want to give them an answer, but he wants to give them an answer,
I think he is giving them an
and
answer.
he does give them an answer as
By
they
him
continue.
turning it around like that, he's demonstrating his authority.
Yes, he demonstrates that he understands authority, that for To answer that question, in given what the question is about, and that is, are you the Son of God? The only one who could answer that question is God himself, right? He's going to say, as he did at the baptism, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." Apparently, they weren't there or didn't remember that, or maybe it wasn't something that everybody heard. I don't know. But that's the ultimate testimony, and the testimony of scriptures, which is also the word of God, which they knew. And I think what Jesus is going to do is perhaps answer the question by having them think about it more deeply. It's almost like a Socratic method in some ways, because what he does is he tells another parable, which we can read now. Then began he to speak to the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard and led it forth to husbandmen and went into a far country for a long time. And at the season he sent a servant to the husbandmen that they should give him of the fruit of the vineyard. But the husbandmen beat him and sent him away empty. And again he sent another servant, and they beat him also and entreated him shamefully and sent him away empty. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also and cast him out. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son, and maybe they will reverence him when they see him." But when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours." So they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore shall the Lord of the vineyard do unto them? He shall come and destroy these husbandmen and shall give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, "God forbid." And he beheld them and said, "What is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner. Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder." So this parable, I think they get the point very, very strongly. The parable is about a vineyard. The husbandman is obviously God, and the servants that he sends that are consistently rejected by
Prophets.
are the prophets. All the prophets that prophesied about Jesus all that time and were never taken seriously, even in their own day when they were prophesying. Until it comes down where the son himself is sent, and they figure, okay, he's the heir. We'll kill him and we'll gain control of this vineyard, which is what they wanted all along, obviously. The reason they were rejecting the servants is because they didn't want to submit to the authority of the true Lord of the vineyard. They felt they had a good thing going there for themselves. The Lord was absent and they were given control of it, and as long as they were able to maintain that control, all the benefit went to them. They get the point because they say, "God forbid," at the end, but I think that answers their question, by what authority do I say these things? Obviously, Jesus is the prophesied son that would be sent. And we go on from there. The chief priests and the scribes, the same hour, sought to lay hands on him, and they feared the people, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them. And they watched him and sent forth spies, which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, that so they might deliver him unto the power and authority of the governor. This is interesting. What they're trying to do, since they can't take hold of them because they would incur the wrath of the people, they want to get him in trouble with the political powers. So they ask him a different question. We know that thou sayest and teachest rightly, neither acceptest thou the person of any, but teachest the way of God truly. Is it lawful for us to give tribute unto Caesar or no? But he perceived their craftiness and said unto them, Why tempt you me? Show me a penny. Whose image and superscription hath it? They answered and said, Caesar's. And he said unto them, Render therefore unto Caesar the things which be Caesar's, and unto God the things which be God's. And they could not take hold of his words before the people, and they marveled at his answer and held their peace.
Right. So when they couldn't get him on religious grounds,
Right.
then they tried to get him on political grounds
Right.
by they were expecting him to say Caesar means nothing. And so then
Yeah.
they, oh, he's trying to start a
A
insurrection,
revolution.
you know?
Yeah.
And he's, and then that would have been, it's interesting that the religious leaders thought that way. It's like, if we could get him to appear like a political enemy, then he'll get thrown in jail, and then that'll be the end of his ministry. And either way, he'll be silenced, you know.
It's very interesting.
It's a great response that he gives. It's like, whose image is that? That's Caesar's? Then give it to Caesar.
Yep. Yeah. And it's very deep because that, what more can you say?
Yeah, no, it's a great answer.
Yeah, I think so too. Then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there is any resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Master, who Moses wrote unto us, if any man's brother die having a wife, and he die without children, then his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. There were therefore seven brethren, and the first took a wife and died without children. And the second took her to wife, and he died childless. And the third took her, and in like manner the seven also, and they left no children and died. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven had her to wife. This is interesting because the Sadducees don't believe in a resurrection. So, why are they giving a hypothetical question? That is based on
Yeah,
something
that
that they don't
happens
believe
all
in.
the time.
Yeah.
People will ask you questions about things that they don't believe
That they
in
don't believe.
order, right, in order to expose the
Ludicrousness of what you believe, right?
right. Yeah.
Exactly. So if they can ask you a question that you can answer, okay, now we showed that what you believe is ludicrous.
Right. Right.
You can't even defend what you're saying is true.
Yeah.
So Jesus turns this one completely around too, because he knows they don't believe in the resurrection. And he says, you don't even understand what the resurrection is like. You think it's going to be a continuation of the life that goes on in this world, with the same kind of rules. It's a whole new order. In the resurrection, there's not it, men aren't people aren't going to go around getting married. They're going to be like the angels. They're never going to die. And so you can't apply the thing, you can't think as if the resurrection is just a continuation of this life. It's something that's different than that. And then he asked them the question, now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush when he called the Lord, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he's not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. Then certain of the scribes answering said, Master, thou hast well said. Now, we got one more. And after that, they durst not ask him any question at all. And now he says something to them. He asks them a question. How say they that Christ is David's son? And this gets back, I think, to the first question they asked him, by what authority do you say these things? He says, okay, you know that according to the prophets, the Psalms, that Christ is supposed to be David's son. Why do you believe that? Because David said, and he quotes Psalm, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies thy footstool. David therefore calleth him Lord. How is he then his son? Now, I don't think Jesus is saying that he's not his son, because obviously, because the scriptures say that the Messiah will be the son of David. But the question is, how or how can he say that he is his son and yet call him Lord? Isn't it obvious that there's something more than just physical relationship going on here? David isn't seeing the Messiah as just one of his event, descendants. He's seeing the Messiah as being someone that has been given authority from God, so that David himself has to call him Lord. You see what I'm saying? That is the Messiah. Then in the audience of all the people, he said unto his disciples, beware of the scribes which desire to walk in long robes and love greetings in the markets and the highest seats in the synagogues and chief rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses and for show make long prayers. The same shall receive greater damnation. I think when I read this earlier, I even saw a connection between that statement and what was said earlier, but I don't see it right now. Trying to think. Well, the perhaps with the rulers of the vineyard who wanted to take control of the vineyard for their own personal benefit. I think there's a relationship there. The desire to wear long robes and get the greetings in the marketplace. In other words, their ministry wasn't supposed, as the leaders of God's people, wasn't to be for their benefit. It was to be for the benefit. It was to minister or to give the blessings of, bring the blessings of God to the people through their administration. It wasn't so that they could be personally blessed as an end in and of itself. Well, you want to go on to another 21? Why don't you read this one, John?
All right. And he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a certain widow putting in two mites. So he said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all, for all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God, but she out of her poverty put in all the livelihood that she had. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Hold on.
You want to comment on some of this?
Let's do that.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
The first parable is rather self-explanatory, but it's a really good point that it's no sacrifice really for you if you're rich and wealthy and you make a donation. Really, I used to say this at, even that, you see a bunch of millionaires and people do that. Like if you're a billionaire and it's like, Bill Gates and all these people do that. They make these donations like, oh, I've donated, $100,000 to that. That's nothing, or to and they're always praised for that. Oh, they're these generous, philanthropic people that do all these things. Like, that's nothing to them. But the person who's sacrificing his time, maybe he's a father and a husband, and he's going out there and donating his time. It's like, that's a greater sacrifice, and that never gets highlighted,
Yeah, but I don't think it's just the amount of sacrifice, although I'm not denying that it certainly shows a great deal of faith on the part of this woman, because for her to put in all of her living, so to speak, and like her entire salary, what's she going to live on? So what really is amazing is the faith that she had that God would provide for her. Whereas the rich man who made the donation, it didn't require any faith. He knows he's got plenty of money. He can still make it. He can get by without trusting in God at all. But look at it this way. Now, there's another way I think you can look at this, because it's true that the Bill Gates or anybody like that who makes these enormous donations, if you're talking about solving some problem, that will do it. The poor widow who donates one penny, it's not going to make a bit of difference. So, from the standpoint of the world, if you set aside the spiritual dimension, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, the widow is more to be praised than the rich man, because she is really not doing anything. Only the rich man is. But I think Jesus' point is
Only
that
the rich man is. No, I know
it's
what you mean. And I you're right. If you remove the spiritual element from it, you're
but yeah,
100% right.
and I think that's what Jesus is
It's
trying to
looking up
show, that God
instead of
doesn't
doing
need
anything,
Doesn't
you don't even
God
need
doesn't
God.
need the your money in any case, because the whole world is his. It's not that God needs your money to get something done. He wants your heart, and it's the poor widow who showed the faith and the devotion, not the rich man who did it because he knew people would see how much he was putting in, and they would be thinking highly of him for it. So it's like a whole different way of looking at the problem. I don't think Jesus is even concerned about is looking at charity in terms of what it can accomplish. In other words, we often think, well, the reason we give is because there's a need that has to be met. And I think God is saying the reason we give is to show that we acknowledge that everything we have is God's. And that's our act of acknowledging that. And anyway, continue.
And then we had the stones will not be left one upon the other.
Where was that? Oh,
That's
the
the very
temple.
next thing where they were commenting on the
Yeah,
adornment of
I
the
think the reason this follows so closely is because, again, you have an example of people who are looking at the outward appearance and missing the spiritual meaning underneath, like we were talking about last week when you were saying, what do these things symbolize? What's the meaning underneath it? Weren't you asking that? Or was that Anthony, maybe? It might have been something Anthony had said earlier last week. I'm sorry. I got the two mixed up.
That's all right.
But what I want to comment further on that, though, because it was a good point that he was making. I just don't remember. I think it had to do with the holy days and the Sabbaths, and he was saying, I know we're not obligated to keep these, but the point is, because because they were types and, symbols of spiritual realities. But he was saying, but what is the spiritual reality that we should be taking away from these things? And I think that's the question here. They're looking at the temple and saying, oh, it's look at how beautiful it is and how wonderful it is that we can, that all these donations are beautifying the temple. But they're not seeing that the temple is the house of God. There's a spiritual dimension to it. And the reason he says this is because, given the fact that that spiritual dimension is being ignored, there's judgment that's going to be coming on the people of Jerusalem. That temple is going to be destroyed. That temple that they're taking in a literal way to the exclusion of the spiritual meaning behind it, it's going to be broken down. And they so can. That's all I wanted to add to that.
All right. And then, so they asked him, saying, Teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? And he said, Take heed that you do not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he. And the time has drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. Then he said to them, Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience, possess your souls. I guess we'll stop there,
Okay,
because there's a lot there.
yeah, there is. Well, in a sense here, I think he's saying don't, there's going to be a lot of disturbances on the political and the natural realm. But he's saying, in essence, this. It's the beginning. It might be the th that which precedes the end, but it is not the end itself. Nine may be the important pr verse. Be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass.
Yeah.
Not to be terrified by this. I think even in the when he talks about being persecuted and being brought before kings for the sake of Christ, even there he's giving an assurance. Number one, don't worry about what you're going to say. And number two, even though you'll be hated for by all men for my sake, he says, there shall not an hair of your head perish. Now, if it sort of seems contradictory, because he says they shall cause, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. Well, how can both be true? But there's something about this. It's like, yeah, some of you shall be put to death, but not a hair of your head is going to perish, in the sense that none of this is going to happen outside of the will of God and outside of a situation in which God is present with you and strengthening you by His grace through these situations that you're going to be facing. And I think that's what he means by in your patience, possess your souls. It's the patience in the sense of holding on to your faith and closeness to God in the midst of these outwardly terrifying situations. You can look at the earthquakes and the stars falling from the sky and everything and be terrified and say, oh, now the world's come down. What am I going to do? And running and doing this and that. Or you can be confident that this is part of God's plan and He's with you. And in that kind of facing of tribulation, that's the patience by which you possess your souls. Now, I'm not saying it. I think there's some in the next two verses that it's not passivity necessarily that we're talking about either. Read those and see what I see if that's.
But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So
Okay.
I'll continue.
Do you want should we talk about that?
Yeah.
In some, I always, I know a lot of times we know that Jerusalem at the end is going to be surrounded by armies at the very end times, but I think he's talking about the initial destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, because he says they shall that if Jerusalem's going to be destroyed and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, be led away of all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So when is the time of the Gentiles fulfilled? Isn't that point,
Question.
isn't that the end? The end, the tribulation, the beginning of the tribulation period?
Right.
So it's like there's the first destruction, but it's premonition of the one that will come later after the time of the Gentiles. Because then it says there shall be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars and upon the earth distress of nations. With perplexity, the sea and waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So, maybe that's. Maybe we should. It sort of puts a different time emphasis on thing. It almost implies like maybe all those prophecies about the destruction of Jerusalem have been fulfilled. I don't know. But anything that which has been shall is that which shall be is still also a principle. So I don't know. Right now, you certainly see. So the situation there where that could happen at any time in that area, because the nations are getting increasingly impatient. with Israel.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was just reading. What are they getting impatient about?
Because they're not able to work out a peace settlement with the Palestinians or any of the Arab peoples around them. Don't you see that?
Yeah.
I mean, the United Nations condemned Netanyahu as a war criminal. I think it's pretty tenuous right now on the, out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking about, not only I guess that's what I was reading, I was rereading through these things. And not only do we see what's going on in Israel, but then all of these sights, these fearful sights and signs from heaven, and it says that there's going to be signs in the sun, and so there's going to be like this cosmic chaos, which is interesting. Anyway, so we left off as then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now, when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. Then he spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And in the daytime he was teaching the temple, but at night he went out and stayed on the mountain called Olivet. Then early in the morning all the people came to him in the temple to hear him.
I think that the whole point of him giving these instructions is not to cause fear. And I am emphasizing that because I think a lot of times that's the reaction that we have. Like, how are we going to be able to get through this, and what's it going to be like? His main concern is that we not fall into, in verse 34, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness. In other words, that's thinking that everything is, the purpose of life is just to have a good time, and the cares of this life, and the purpose, and I have to be concerned about my job and everything to the extent that that's all I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about how do I get money? How do I enjoy myself? Because it's a, he says, for a snare shall come on them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. This is in essence the not watching and waiting. It's becoming enmeshed in the system.
Yeah.
Watch ye therefore and pray always that ye may be counted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass. That's all.
Yeah, that's the struggle, is not getting caught up in the system, because I think the world wants to wants you to be caught up in that. You know, I feel that way at work. I think that my bosses want me to be kind of, you know, even when I'm not working, reading things, studying up on things, worrying about things, anticipating things. It's like, you know, you're always just thinking about work, 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 and that's their whole lives. Then
That's interesting.
you don't really have room for anything else, and they don't see that anyway.
Yeah, that may be that's very interesting observation. I think Satan is interested in that.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times
I
the people in the world are unwittingly the emissaries of Satan in
yes.
one way or another. I don't know how that happens, but it's
Well, yeah, and you know, I think, and then people look at that as being exemplary, like, oh wow, look at this person. They're, you know, working late and every night, and on, you know, it's you're so wrapped up in the system that how do you have time for prayer or for reading the scriptures?
Yeah, and it's even more than the time, it's the heart. It's where your heart is.
Yeah.
Because you could not be, have a job at all, and you could have a heart that was still set on the world.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But the thing is, that's one of the it's a way to get your heart. And that's the thing. The Proverbs say, "Keep your heart, for out of it, above all, keep your heart, for out of it are the issues of life."
Yeah. Man, I think if I wasn't working, I would have so much more time to read and study. I don't think I would become negligent.
Yeah, but the problem with that is, John, with the point of the reading and study is to live. You need both. In other words, you need the reading and the study so that you're prepared to live out what you gain from the reading and studying in a context in which God has put you. So I don't think God requires us to become like monks, where all we do is, read and pray and meditate all day long. Because you need to be able to work out in a real life situation the lessons that you've learned. And if you isolate yourself to the point where you don't have those opportunities, I think it impedes your ability to learn. Now, granted, if you're caught up in the system where you have no opportunity to learn at all, that's bad too. You need both.
Yeah.
You need the time to study, and you need the opportunity to
To exercise it.
walk through the valley of the shadow of death with the strength that you've gained from the Lord by your time of fellowship with Him.
Yeah.
Well, okay, we did two chapters,
Yeah,
and
I think that the next one's rather long. I
yeah,
don't.
I don't think we should try to tackle that. We can get that next time.
Yeah.
All righty.
Well, thank you, Dad. I hope
Thank
that
you guys. It was always enjoy it, and I always meditate on what we say during, the next few days, and it's all you can learn more then.
Oh,
It's
that's
good.
good. Me too. I always do that too.
All right, we're going to end the meeting.
All
Well,
right, Dad. Thank
Carmen,
you.
John, have a wonderful week to come.